Today on Vox Talks Economics, how many lives could be saved if rich countries shared their vaccines? Welcome to Vox Talks Economics from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. My name is Tim Phillips. Every week we bring you the best new research in economics, so remember to subscribe and follow us on Instagram now. 5 billion COVID vaccine doses have been administered so far, but only just over 1% of people in low-income countries have received even a single dose. Should high-income countries be more ambitious about sharing their stockpile of vaccines, and how many lives would be saved if they did? Mehdi Benatia Andalusi of the International Monetary Fund is one of the authors of a new paper that estimates the impact in lives saved if this were to happen. He's here today. Welcome to Vox Talks Economics.
Thank you for having me, Tim.
You've called the time until the end of 2021 critical months to save lives. Why?
It's a race between vaccinations and the virus. Vaccines have shown they significantly reduce death risks following infections, including for groups that are most at risk of death. Yet in the next few months, vaccines will be in short supply in many low and middle income countries as global production capacity is maxed out. The good news is that there are enough vaccines globally to vaccinate all high risk individuals in the next few months. That is why the next few months are so critical to save lives through vaccine sharing. We can protect the most high risk individuals globally, and the sooner this is done, the more lives can be saved.
You've called this paper a thought experiment, and that's because you've abstracted away from the political and logistical challenges of sharing and delivering vaccines, which are considerable, aren't they? Why did you approach it in this way?
We want to ask, you know, given the supply bottlenecks worldwide, what can be done to vaccinate the world? And in a world where vaccines were globally allocated to high-risk individuals, first, instead of the national vaccination campaigns that we see, how many lives could be saved? So that's the thought experiment that we ask. And we call that a thought experiment for three main reasons. The first is because the analysis rests on a counterfactual world in which vaccines are optimally allocated globally to target individuals that are most at risk of death instead of the national vaccination campaigns that we see. In a way, our thought experiment here reproduces the vaccination campaigns that we have seen in many countries where priority was given to high-risk individuals. But we do so globally instead of within each country. The second reason why we call this a thought experiment is that, as you said, we abstract from the logistical and legal difficulties that may exist and that do exist and may delay the sharing of vaccines internationally. This is an approximation, of course, but one that we thought was sensible, as supply bottlenecks are the first order impediment for vaccinations in many parts of the world. And the third reason is that the results of the analysis crucially depend on key parameters that are difficult to measure or project and remain highly uncertain. In the paper, we outline many approximations that we make. We try to be very transparent about them. At the end of the day, this is a back-of-the-envelope exercise. We want to calculate an order of magnitude of the number of lives that could be saved if we prioritize vaccinations of high-risk individuals globally.
Considering the detail you've gone into, it's the back of a pretty big envelope. But let's put some numbers on the scale of vaccine nationalism. Vaccine production has largely been snapped up by advanced economies who, by and large, have enough. How much of the world is outside of that group?
In the paper and for the purpose of the analysis, we divided the world in five country groups. The advanced economies, China, India, another group with other emerging markets, and the fifth group with the low-income countries. When we wrote the paper in June, advanced economies and China were on course to have enough vaccines to cover their populations fully by the end of the year. And we're on course to have surpluses. There's about 1.1 billion individuals in advanced economies in our model, 1.4 in China, 1.4 in India, about 2.3 in emerging markets, and about 1.6 billion individuals in low-income countries. And as you said, many countries in the low-income group were able to only vaccinate only a few percent of their population so far. And many high-risk individuals thus remain unprotected from the vaccines globally that will be at risk of death infected.
Let's also talk about who you think those high-risk individuals are. How do you define which people are at risk if they're not vaccinated, and how many people fall into this category globally?
The first thing we do in the paper is really try to determine who are high-risk individuals in each of the five country groups. And we define high-risk populations are those pertaining to age groups presenting a probability of dying of 2.5% and above following infection. For advanced economies where data is more readily available from past waves, this roughly corresponds to populations aged 65 and above. For emerging markets and low-income countries, there are greater healthcare system constraints. The like we saw in India, where many lives could not be saved because of oxygen shortages and hospitals' capacity constraints. So scientists have modeled that healthcare systems constraints lead to higher risk of death for infected people during infection surges. And that is because when people get sick and go to the hospitals, if there are healthcare system constraints, they cannot be treated and many may end up dying. And this means in practice that younger groups can be considered high risk of death following infections in emerging markets and low-income countries. And given this 2.5% threshold that I just talked about, this leads us to consider using the infection fatality ratios that scientists have modeled. This leads us to consider populations aged 55 and above at high risk in emerging markets and about 45-year-old and above in India and low-income countries. The second part of your question was about how many of high-risk individuals are there. And to determine that, we use the demographic structure of each country group and those 2.5% threshold to estimate that the total high-risk populations globally amounts to 1.4 billion individuals. There's about 200 million high-risk individuals in advanced economies, about 200 million in China, about 400 million in emerging markets, and about 600 million in India and low-income countries. And that's because we take into consideration the healthcare system constraints in those country groups.
Now, in advanced economies, it's always in the news, the progress of the pandemic. You have to make certain assumptions for how the pandemic will spread through the other four categories. So for China and India first, what assumptions do you make about the spread of the pandemic?
That's right. Part of this exercise rests on projections or assumptions about the potential path of the pandemic in each of these five country groups. And I just want to say that we considered the path of the pandemic to be totally exogenous from vaccinations. That means that we consider that vaccinated individuals can be infected and transmit the virus, but they cannot die following infection in our model. To factor in uncertainties about the future evolution of the pandemic in each of these country groups, we perturbate the timing and severity of future waves in different runs of the model. And in particular, for China and advanced economies in particular, we actually assume that the number of infections would remain quite low at the level of what we observed in June. That's because those country groups, in particular China, has shown a capacity to contain infections in the past. And for India, we assume that the spring wave of infections was to abate by mid-summer of 2021. And we didn't assume any new additional waves of infections for the rest of 2021 in India.
And what about emerging markets and low-income countries? I imagine it's a different story there.
Precisely. In those country groups, we assume that COVID-19 waves mimic the 2020-2021 winter wave that we observed in advanced economies with similar shape but higher severity. We assume higher severity, including to adjust for the potential undermeasurement of past cases in advanced economies, and also to adjust for lower capacity to enforce lockdowns in low-income countries and emerging markets. Timing, the future waves that we assume are projected to peak between July 2021 and January 2022 in different runs of the model. So as I mentioned earlier, we rerun the model about 1,000 times with different assumptions about the waves that can happen in different countries. And we assume that the number of new infections per million people, which is the measure of severity that we take, is projected to be about between 1 and 5 times as high as the average wave in advanced economies in this past winter. And just for comparison, the US wave of infection was about twice as bad as the average wave in other advanced economies. So that gives you a point of comparison already.
Now, of course, you're not the first person to point out that it would be good to share vaccines. There is an international initiative to do that called COVAX. How is COVAX supposed to work?
COVAX is the joint venture between the World Health Organization, the Center of Epidemic Preparedness and Innovation, CEPI, the Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance, and the UNICEF. It was set up in response to the COVID pandemic in April of 2020. And the idea behind the program is that COVAX would pre-purchase large quantities of vaccines from major manufacturers, then allocate vaccines globally in a way that every country got an equitable share based on the size of their population. COVAX has a variety of funding sources, wealthy countries, private organizations, international organizations. And by June, it had raised more than $9 billion, or enough to purchase about 1.8 billion doses and cover 30% of the population in the world's 92 poorest countries. Those countries are eligible to get vaccines for free from COVAX. The target would be to get them by mid-2022. To date, COVAX delivered 209 million doses to about 140 countries. And one aspect to have in mind is that in the short run, in those next few months that we call so critical in the paper, there will be supply shortfalls as the global vaccine manufacturing infrastructure is maxed out. And deliveries of the vaccines bought in bulk by COVAX may only happen later in 2021 or early in 2022. So in addition to this bulk purchasing program that COVAX has, surplus countries can also donate doses through COVAX. And actually many advanced economies and China have promised to do so.
Given the assumptions that you've made in your model, what would be the impact of COVAX working as it should?
So indeed, in the paper, we could not run that scenario explicitly, and I give you the reason why. The way we calculate the number of deaths that can be avoided thanks to the early sharing of vaccines is by comparing the outcomes of two vaccine distribution scenarios. The first vaccine is the baseline scenario. In this scenario, countries access vaccines only through contracts that had already been signed with manufacturers back in June, and including those contracts that had been signed by COVAX as of June. So that we factored in some of the COVAX projections for deliveries throughout the end of the year. And our second scenario against which we compare the baseline scenario is the vaccine sharing scenario. In this scenario, countries that are projected to accumulate surpluses by the end of the year are assumed to start sharing part of the vaccines they already received as soon as 50% of their populations is fully vaccinated. We chose that threshold because we observed that after 50% of the population is vaccinated, demand in those countries started to wane and they started to accumulate vaccines that could be used immediately in other parts of the world. Under that scenario, surplus countries would start sharing vaccines as soon as June 2021.
So let me ask you another question in that case. What is the life-saving impact of that scenario, the 50% then share, over your baseline scenario?
Using those projections for vaccine availability at the country group level and using this vaccine sharing scenario, we calculate that we could vaccinate fully all high-risk individuals globally by October 2021, or about 3 months earlier than the baseline scenario without additional sharing. That would lead, given assumptions that we make for the potential path of the virus, to up to 800,000 saved lives thanks to the sharing of vaccines in that scenario. And again, vaccines would be shared as soon as June 2021 and every month a bit more.
But of course, the frustration is we are now not in June 2021 anymore. And what you hoped for in your thought experiment has not come to pass. So that ambitious projection that could save 800,000 lives, how much do we have to scale it down now to say, if this started happening right now, how many lives could we save?
The gains, as you mentioned, crucially depend on the timing of vaccine sharing. And so should vaccines only be shared from October onwards, which is a scenario that we also run, the model projects that about 200,000 lives could be saved in 2021 thanks to those sharing, assuming the same waves as in the other scenarios that we discussed. I just want to highlight one more time a few important shortfalls in this analysis. The first is that the results depend on the timing and severity of future waves, something that is impossible to predict. It also depends on the efficiency of vaccines. And we assume that vaccines are 100% effective in protecting against death. And it also rests on the approximation that non-high-risk individuals cannot die from the virus, which may not hold under further mutations. So something to keep in mind when we read those numbers. But definitely one thing that is sure in, you know, all the runs that we do in the models to account for the uncertainties around these parameters is that the timing of sharing is critical, and that the longer we wait, the fewer lives will be saved.
It just gives us an idea of the enormous scale of the trade-off that we're making when we indulge in vaccine nationalism, and that the clock is ticking. Thank you very much for coming and talking about it today.
Thank you very much.
If you want to read this paper, it is DP16372, How Many Lives Could Be Saved Through the Early Sharing of Vaccines Globally. And the authors are Mehdi Benatia Andalusi and Antonios Bilimbergo. This has been a Vox Talk from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. Every week we bring you the most important latest research. So if you want to know what you're going to be reading in journals 18 months from now, listen to Vox Talks Economics today. And there's 12 years of Vox Talks as ever at voxeu.org/vox-talks.